Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the victim of a previous mass shooting at a house of worship who just attended the memorial service at the AME Church in Charleston, where he found comfort from the latest victims on Father's Day in remembrance of his father, who in 2012 was gunned down in his Wisconsin Sikh temple by a white racist. Amardeep Kaleka, a Emmy Award-winning film director who since his father's murder has been an advocate for gun control and hate crime legislation, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, American Dream Disturbed, and the governor of South Carolina's call to take down the Confederate flag that was the only flag not lowered to half-mast at the state capitol. Then we'll speak with Naomi Oreskes, a professor of the history of science at Harvard University and the co-author of the new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. We will discuss how her work helped inform Pope Francis in the preparation of his encyclical on the environment and how her new book, Grounded in Science, portrays our planet in the not-too-distant future as a pile of filth the Pope warns against. Then, finally, with the release of a new study at the journal Science Advances by Stanford, Princeton, and Berkeley scientists, we'll examine the sixth mass extinction phase that the Earth has now entered following the fifth 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. An expert on mass extinctions, Peter Ward, a paleontologist who teaches biology and Earth and space sciences at the University of Washington, joins us. He is the author of Under a Green Sky, a book that points out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change. Joining us now is Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He has an article at the Huffington Post, American Dream Disturbed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amardeep Kaleka.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be with you again.
And I take it, Amardeep, it was a tough Father's Day for you because on August the 5th of 2012, your father, Satwant Singh Kaleka, was murdered in his own church on a Sunday morning by a neo-Nazi who shot a number of people in the temple as well as your father. And you're just returning from Charleston, South Carolina, where you attended the memorial at the AME Church. So I guess did that coincide with Father's Day?
Oh, man. Yeah, the Father's Day was really rough. Being away from my own two children is always tough. But being away from my father because he was taken at the Sikh Temple in Wisconsin is, also tough. But then seeing all of this travesty in Charleston with the nine families losing their loved ones and how many fathers are affected there. What a tough Father's Day around America.
And the incidents are sort of grimly very similar, are they not? Particularly to the extent that your father died a hero trying to, even though he was shot multiple times by the neo-Nazi American former army sergeant, he fought off the gunman, saving many lives, including your mother's, defending his church or his house of worship. And apparently, in the shooting at the AME church in Charleston, Felicia Sanders sacrificed her body to cover and shield her young granddaughter, while her son, Tawanza, tried to talk the gunman down to distract him. And then, although the granddaughter was saved, Tawanza was not saved.
With Miss Sanders and her shielding her young granddaughter and her son's sacrifice of his life, I think the Sanders family knows and understands the ultimate of human sacrifices in this country. To lose a loved one at the hands of injustice and hatred and violence that need not even be there.
Well, there are also tragic similarities in terms of the shooters. In the case of the neo-Nazi former army sergeant who killed your father and others in the temple, he apparently wasn't particularly well-educated, or at least ill-educated. He thought he was attacking Muslims and said he was attacking Sikhs. And then in the case of Dylan Roof, the 21-year-old, his father gave him a gun as a birthday present, which I believe is illegal, but certainly not unusual in South Carolina. He was obviously influenced by white power racism that is not based on anything but primitive reactionary emotions. So do you see a similarity there?
There's a lot, especially with the gun purchase. Here we have an illegal federal gun purchase because there was no background check done on it. Had there been, we would have caught the fact that he was, I believe he was something to do with a felony. He was right about to come to his court date, so he shouldn't have a gun. But on the state level, it was legal. It was fully legal because 40 out of 50 of the United States of America believe it's all right to sell a gun to somebody despite what their background is, though it might be atrocious. So these are things that we aimed to rectify after Sandy Hook, which we went to Congress and lobbied all the way to a vote. And ultimately, we got to a point where congressmen didn't believe the same as the 80% of Americans who did believe in the same law. It should be a universal law. Selling guns to somebody always should require it. Any instrument of destruction that can take a life force should have to be checked, especially at just the basic levels.
Well, unfortunately, in America, because of our political system, the quality of an argument and its moral, rational basis doesn't win the day. What wins the day is money and political blackmail, and that's what the NRA does very well. They fund candidates and they punish candidates who vote against their dictates by funding opponents. So that's the sad part, is that 80% of the country has to somehow wake up and fight fire with fire, as far as I can tell, unless you have another alternative approach.
Well, I have a few alternative approaches, especially in the nonviolent protest sector. Call me anytime about those, but I want to really, really, really talk about what creates that. It's this last 50 to 60 years of heavy, heavy, heavy spending in the military arm of our government. And we have created such a strong military sector that creates a strong gun lobby, that creates a strong defense and missile systems approach to our science, that we are all, put in jeopardy. And by all, I mean everybody on the planet, because we have the most nuclear bombs and we have shown the capability to use them on other humans. So now we're in this predicament where we have to take what's called a war economy. That's what I would label it as. I don't know what other people would. But we have to dismantle it and put up a peace economy. And peace economists, I think, would side with the fact of working on your knowledge sector, getting your universities up there, getting your high school and middle school schooling to the best that it can be so it can compete in a global marketplace that is on full speed right now. We're driving 60 and they're going 82. Like, we have to catch where the rate of expansion is if we want to be competitive in the marketplace. And I think most Americans know this because we can feel the pinch of the recession. And the recession wasn't caused by anything but the spending in the wrong areas.
Well, there's certainly Main Street suffered and Wall Street was rewarded for their sins. There's no question about that. And again, I'm speaking with Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He has an article at the Huffington Post, American Dream Disturbed. And Amardeep, you mentioned the state's laws that allowed, particularly in South Carolina, allowed this shooter who was facing a court date in under federal law. He didn't have a background check done on him, which would have disallowed the purchase of a gun, or in terms of his father giving it to him. I don't quite know how the law works in that regard, but state laws throughout this country, as you point out, are very lax in terms of guns. But the state of South Carolina has gotten so much backlash over the obscenity of the Confederate battle flag, which is a symbol of slavery, at the state capitol was not lowered to half-mast, whereas the American flag and the state flag of South Carolina was, after the shooting at the AME church in Charleston, and just outraged the nation. It was so in your face. And as a result of the South Carolina legislature's passage of a law that made it impossible to lower the flag without a supermajority, which of course is how all of these Jim Crow laws were enacted. It's an old segregationist trick, the supermajority. And now we have Governor Nikki Haley and also Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who's running for president, calling for the flag to be removed from the grounds of the state capitol. Does that give you any comfort?
I mean, there's a lot of things that give me comfort. One of them is not the shooting down of a Confederate flag, because I would rather have it just been brought down immediately. It is a symbol not just of slavery. It's a symbol of a separatist movement from the South that tried to secede from our great nation based on immoral grounds. And that fight has long been fought and has been fought on a federal level, but some of our states don't get this. And South Carolina happens to be one of them. And I lived in Georgia for quite a bit, and I do think that there are very progressive areas of each of these great states. And I'm hoping that the leadership in those progressive areas comes together, interfaith-based, intercommunity-based, gets together and debunks the notion of racism and says, hey, simply put, there's no such thing as race. We are the human race. Simply put, we have different cultures and different backgrounds.
But you can't legislate hate away. I assume that the only way to get rid of hate is to educate it away. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, hate is a construct built inside of us. It's not born with you. You don't hate much as a child. You might, not have taste for certain things. But hate is a construct that grows inside of us based on our fear. Fear is a direct connection to the way that both parties have been running their political system, using fear to advertise, using fear to manipulate and divide humans that are, pretty content with each other and pretty cool with each other and can drink in fellowship and can laugh in fellowship, can study in fellowship and have a great nation. We've already proven that. Right now, people are using this fear to create this drive to the polls or drive to the marketplace or drive to buy this thing. And that fear, I think, ultimately is leading to this anger and hate. And if we can do simple things in the street, like just say hi to each other, if we can nod our heads like our two or three generations ago did in the streets of, New York in the 18th or 17th or 19th century, or 19th and 20th century, if we can do that, then I think these nine families, these horrible atrocities would end, and these nine families would not need to have given up so much blood in vain.
So tell me about, since you were in South Carolina for the memorial, I take it were you at the AME church?
I was at the AME church praying with so many diverse parishioners. Outside of the church, though, however, I was expecting that it would be maybe 5,000 to 6,000 to 7,000 on a Sunday morning, especially in Charleston, where it's called the Holy City, because they have so many steeples in just one little five-block radius. But instead of 5,000 people, we had about a good 1,000, and it was a good, strong crowd. But on a Sunday, after such a horrific event, I was hoping more and more families and people of the area would come together and help Mother Emmanuel, which is the term that the neighborhood called the church, Mother Emmanuel. And it's a very strong and powerful term, because in Mother Emmanuel, there's so much that
Were the congregation of Mother Emmanuel that you met with, were they aware of your father's murder at his house of worship, and, you know, in terms of the tragic similarities?
A number of people, you know, came and approached, and we talked about it. They knew of it, and we were there more, though, to grieve and to pray in unity with these amazing, amazing people who just forgave a man who has done such an atrocious act. And I was there to learn from them. I was there to listen to every word the preacher was saying, and it was an amazing. I mean, Ian, I can tell you it was amazing because, look, they had preachers outside holding up prayer service throughout the night. They were trying their best to hold it 24 hours, but, you know, people get tired. Hopefully, you know, they can hold it up. And it was such a beautiful sight and so powerful, but it was also so mixed, so sad.
And do you think that, you know, you mentioned earlier after Sandy Hook, 80% of the public wanted something done on gun control, but the Congress, being the cowards and whores and hirelings that so many of them are, under the sway of the NRA, blocked it and nothing was done. And the president actually, against the advice of the Democratic Party, put his prestige on the line because he felt it was necessary and he felt strongly about it. And when this latest massacre took place, he made the comment, he said, I keep having to make these speeches. You know, this is something that, and as the president pointed out, this is unique to America. We are the only advanced industrial country on the planet that has such a rash of mass killings because of, we have the best armed criminals in the world. We have the best armed mentally unstable people in the world, thanks to the NRA and their influence over Congress.
Ian, I think we have a political class of entrepreneurs who become politicians. That's what I think. I think we have a group of people who look at it as if it's a career path that is meant for power, prestige, and wealth. And that is not what it means to hold office in America. That is not what it means to provide service for your fellow mankind. And I think Congress epitomizes that current in its current state, because we have the least amount of bilateral thinking in terms of the Congress that we've ever had in America. And on top of it, we have a Congress that couldn't even pass budgets only years ago. On top of it, after Sandy Hook, couldn't pass a simple rule that we all agree on. And on top of it, has fought our president tooth and nail based on the very racism that brings down 9 beautiful people in a holy city of America. Now that is a failure on the social constructs that we hold as a society. And there's only us to blame. And it's hard to hear these words. This is hard to say. But this is a bitter pill after a very, very strong illness that we have seen and we have all taken part in. There's probably not one of us that is not affected by violence, whether it be gun or aggravated assault or domestic violence. There's not one of us. And that's sad to say.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I'm Adip Kalega.
Ian, thank you for always having me. I apologize for being so long-winded.
No, I appreciate what you've brought to us and the fact that you're just returning from the services at the AME Church in South Carolina that suffered such a grievous loss, and the fact that you've just gotten over Father's Day without your father. So I appreciate you joining us, Amadeep.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amadeep Kalega, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director, who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He has an article at the Huffington Post, American Dream Disturbed. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the collapse of Western civilization, a view from the future. In a little
just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. Speak out loud of the things you are proud of. If you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will conform.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of the history of science and director of graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She is the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, and their latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Oreskes.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
And Naomi, I understand that your work helped inform Pope Francis in the preparation of his encyclical on the environment. And your new book, which is grounded in science, portrays our planet in the not-too-distant future as the pile of filth the Pope has warned against.
Yeah, I know, the pile of filth, that was some pretty strong language. But yes, I was part of a meeting last year at the Vatican, a group of scientists from around the globe who met with leaders of the Vatican to try to lay down a kind of framework for what we think the scientific evidence tells us about the threats that uncontrolled environmental pollution and climate change represent, not just in a physical and scientific way, but also in human and social and cultural terms.
But in terms of your new book, co-authored with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, of course, the Pope is I think, more than anything else motivated by the effect of climate change on the poor, which would be the third world. So I take it you use the title, The Collapse of Western Civilization, as ironically, right?
Yeah, of course. And when we were writing the book, in a way, we were trying to do something similar to what the Pope has done, which is sort of exciting for us. We wanted to really explain why climate change matters, why it matters to people. So the Pope's encyclicals particularly focused on issues of social justice. We were more focused in our book on the question of governance and what climate change means for the survival of Western liberal forms of democracy. Because when we were writing the book, Merchants of Doubt, one of the things we learned was that the people who deny climate change often see themselves as defending democracy. They're afraid that climate change will be used as an excuse to justify a big government control, big government takeover of the economy. But what we tried to point out was that by denying climate change, they actually make that more likely because they increase the likelihood of very disruptive social unrest, food shortages, food riots, the kinds of unrest that, in fact, lead to government takeovers of the marketplace and that lead to the suppression of civil liberties. So if you really care about freedom and democracy, as well as caring about the poor social justice, you really ought to be very, very concerned about uncontrolled climate change.
Well, the intelligence services are. I've spoken to a number of people who have attended international conferences of the various Western intelligence agencies, and for the longest time, climate change has been on the top of the agenda.
Well, that's right. And, you know, in Merchants of Doubt, we talked about that, how the national security organizations, the CIA, the military, have long recognized that climate change represents a national security threat. And the very fact that they do recognize that, and yet we still have climate deniers, you know, in Congress, in Washington, D.C., and elsewhere, pretending that this problem isn't even real, in a way, it shows us how extreme these people have become and how unprincipled their position is, because it's not simply a matter of saying, well, look, we agree on the problem, but we don't agree on the right solution. These people are just in complete and total denial. And again, in the new book, one of the things we try to bring out is, you know, who they really represent. And so we coined this phrase that's gaining a bit of currency, the carbon combustion complex, trying to point out that just as once upon a time we were sort of the prisoners of the military-industrial complex, increasingly we're really prisoners of a carbon combustion complex of people who are doing everything possible, going to any length to defend the right of people to burn cheap fossil fuels, no matter what the cost.
Again, I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's professor of history, the history of science, and director of the graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She's the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And the latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. So there are, of course, we mentioned how the intelligence in terms of the intelligence world and the national security world, they get it in terms of global warming being a clear and present danger. And in contrast, we have the head of the Senate Science Panel and the head of the House Science Panel, both climate change deniers. And your book basically, the narrator of your new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, concludes that in the 21st century, the forces of climate change denial prevailed. So that's the James Imhoff wins the argument, but we all lose the planet, right?
Right. Well, that's the whole premise of the book, is what does this look like if climate change denial prevails? And the answer is it doesn't really look good for the defenders of Western civilization or the defenders of Western-style liberal democracy, that if we don't take action, and so, you know, the story sort of plays out, what does that look like? So we see food riots, unrest, massive sea level rise leads to dislocation of people. And in the story, it's the totalitarian, authoritarian governments like in China that really are more able to cope with the disruption than liberal democracies. And so in the future, a historian in the year 2393 in the Second People's Republic of China looks back on us and says, well, why did this happen? These people knew so much about what was going on. They had so much sophisticated science. They had extremely advanced technology, and yet they allowed this disaster to unfold before their eyes. And so the book is a way of kind of shedding light on what's going on today by looking at it from the perspective of the future.
So in the book, though, what percentage of the Earth is lost to ocean level rise?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if we actually give a percentage, but one of the ways we wrote the book was to take all the scientific evidence and sort of play out a worst-case scenario. So if we took actual scientific work and said, well, what if the high end of these estimates is correct? What does that look like? And so I think ultimately we took an estimate of 11 meters of sea level rise. And actually at the time, I mean, it's now 2 years since we wrote this book, I thought maybe we were pushing the envelope a little bit going that high in terms of sea level rise. But just this week I was talking to a scientist in the United Kingdom who's been studying the Eocene period of geological history a few million years ago. And in the Eocene, carbon dioxide was at 400 parts per million. So that's the same as it is today. And sea level was 11 meters higher than it is today. Now, of course, we won't go to 11 meters of sea level rise overnight. It will take quite a lot of time, probably centuries, for that to unfold. But this is really, really frightening. It means that we are already today at a level of carbon dioxide that if we don't do something essentially immediately, we are looking at a long-term future that really does involve catastrophic sea level rise that would dislocate at least tens, if not hundreds of millions of people around the globe. So this is really not a joke anymore. And it's kind of staggering to me that there are people in Washington, D.C. who can look a camera in the eye and say with a straight face that they think climate change is a hoax, or they don't know what's really happened, they don't know what's causing it. I mean, to say that in light of the amount of scientific evidence that we now have, it's really unconscionable. And I do think that people in the future will look back on these people, and they will not be kind. Future historians, our own grandchildren, will not look kindly on the people who prevented action on climate change.
Well, but in a way, you know, you get the government you deserve, and if we have idiots in our government, you know, it's our fault. I mean, look at the government of Australia. I mean, the guy is a complete idiot. He's an embarrassment. The Australian people they have buyer's remorse, but the reason he got in was that the Labor Party fought amongst itself to the point where people got fed up, and they voted this clown in. And you know, but he's in there to stay for a while. He'll do enormous damage. It's one thing to as I just call them idiots, which I think is a fair term. But it's another thing to, you know, for the our side of the argument, if for the want of a better description, get sufficiently motivated to win power back, particularly if so much power is abdicated by passivity and inertia.
Well, that's certainly true, and I do feel like one of the lessons of history is a reminder that it's really important to stay focused on the big picture and not to let small differences of opinion cause people to lose sight of the shared and common goals. And I've really felt that this week because, you know, there have been some people who have been sort of quibbling with certain aspects of the Pope's encyclical. And, of course, I don't think that anybody, any progressive or liberal or feminist, would have expected to agree with everything that the Pope said. And certainly, I think, you know, many of us might have a slightly different view about birth control than the Pope, let's say. But nevertheless, there's so much that's good and important and correct in the Pope's encyclical, including, in my opinion, his point that we should be focusing on consumption rather than population, which I think is exactly right. I think a lot of people in the United States and elsewhere get that issue wrong. So, you know, the really important thing is to say we are pretty clear here about what needs to happen. We're not all going to agree on all the details. But we do have to sort of, in a way, be compassionate and tolerant to each other and work together. At the same time, I also feel like, you know, when you say we get the government we deserve, I don't really feel that way because I feel like one of the whole points of the book Merchants of Doubt and now the film that we've made with Robbie Kenner is to say, look, we've been the victims of a gigantic fraud. And the victims of fraud are victims. They're not the criminals. The criminals are the people who perpetrate the fraud. So, yes, you could argue we should all be smarter, we should pay more attention. And certainly, Eric Conley and I feel like, now that we've written this book and we've made this wonderful film with Robbie Kenner, anybody who gets fooled by this now, you know, there's not so much an excuse. Like, our eyes have been opened and we need to now not be fooled again. But I do think that we shouldn't be beating up on ourselves for what the Merchants of Doubt has done. I mean, the moral responsibility for that lies with them.
No, I think your point is well taken. And indeed, on the conservative side, with the presidential candidates weighing in against the Pope, the most extraordinary and consistent remark that was made by Jeb Bush and others was essentially that the Pope should stick to moral issues and not meddle in or not lower himself to the political field. And the idea that somehow that you can't talk about politics in terms of global warming. I mean, wait a minute. These are the guys that made it a political issue, right? I mean, it should have been a scientific issue, and had it been that way, there would have been no argumentation. I mean,
I mean, that's complicated. I mean, one of the beauties of this whole week is seeing the incredible gyrations that some Republicans have had to go to disassociate themselves from the Pope. So to say that the Pope shouldn't get involved in politics is completely preposterous because every moral, economic, and social issue is at once also a political issue. So the moment we begin to talk about action to prevent harm, to protect people, of course we're in the realm of politics, and that's absolutely right and appropriate, and that's what moral leadership is all about. So to say that the Pope shouldn't become involved in a political issue is just completely preposterous. But of course, as you point out, it's also completely preposterous because these are the same people who have denied the science all along. So, as you say, exactly, if these people had not been denying the scientific evidence, we could have had a reasonable discussion about appropriate mechanisms to deal with it. But these people have spent 20 years, you know, bending over backwards to deny the science. Now the Pope comes in and says the science is important, and we need to listen to it, and we need to think out what it means, what its implications mean in moral and economic and social terms. And now, you know, we have people on the right wing saying, well, the Pope should leave the science to scientists. Well, that's pretty darn ironic considering the history of the past 20 years.
So in writing your book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, which is sort of science fiction but science fact at the same time, and as we mentioned earlier, the narrator is looking back at the 21st century, lamenting the fact that the deniers won the day and the Earth suffered as a consequence. Is there... In terms of what the Pope was, well, let me ask you this before that. You, my understanding is you as a scientist privately are getting even worse indications of how things are much worse than you even put in the book. I don't know whether you saw the Vice TV series on HBO. They did a piece where they went on the NASA jet that maps the ice, depth of ice over Antarctica. And it was just alarming. The people that are doing the actual research says, this is so much worse than we think. This is just outrageous what's happening. So is that the signal that you're getting, that maybe even in your scenario, you downplay the danger?
No, not worse than we put in The Collapse of Western Civilization. But the whole reason we wrote the book the way it was because we did think that what was unfolding, what was happening, was in fact worse than what was being written in the IPCC reports and the other scientific reports. So we had evidence, and I actually wrote a peer-reviewed paper on this with some colleagues. We had some pretty clear evidence that the mainstream scientific reports coming out of the IPCC and the U.S. National Research Council and being published in the peer-reviewed literature, that these formal scientific reports were underestimating the threat, and that they were well, we called it erring on the side of least drama. They were kind of underplaying the threat, trying to stay calm, trying not to sound alarmist, trying not to sound emotional, hysterical, and that actually those formal reports were erring on the side of the underestimate rather than either being overestimated or correct. And so when Eric and I were writing The Collapse of Western Civilization, we took that to heart and we said, well, what if that's true generally? What if, in general, these scientific estimates are tending to be on the low side? And what if the truth is actually on the high side? And so that was the justification for writing a narrative based on pulling out the implications, not of making things up. Everything in the book, well, with one or two possible exceptions, virtually everything in the book is based on scientific evidence published in peer-reviewed literatures, but taking the high end of the estimates. So, you know, if scientists are saying that doubling warming would lead to 1.5 degrees C, we say, well, what if that upper end, what if that 4.5 is the right answer and not the 1.5? And I think certainly we see evidence that the correct answer is, well, it's probably closer to 3 than it is to 2. And of course, nobody's expecting CO2 to stop at doubling. We have, you know, if we continue where we're on now, we can expect carbon dioxide to go way fast, past 550 parts per million. And now lots and lots of people in the scientific community are talking about climate change of at least 4 degrees. So again, we didn't have to make anything up. We were able to kind of construct a narrative just based on the scientific evidence, assuming that the past estimates have been a little bit too cautious, too conservative, and that the truth is actually really quite worrisome.
Well, just in closing, Naomi Oreskes, the you mentioned how the Pope has concentrated the encyclical on the environment, on consumption and growth as opposed to population. But how do we navigate the irony that we know that as civilizations get more advanced like ours, people tend to have less children, but they consume more. And so the rewards of becoming an advanced society is that you consume more, but you have less children. So how do you alter that trajectory?
Well, right. And this is the big paradox that I think a lot of people don't understand. So many people have talked about this issue in terms of population. And certainly, it is certainly true that, you know, overall, a world with 9 billion people is going to be more environmentally impacted than in a world with 3 billion. But the reality is what you just said. It's not really about how many children you have. It's about how much energy and material consumption those children partake of. And the reality is that the very, very heavy consumption is mostly taking place in places in the world where people actually don't have a lot of children and where population growth rates are very low or even flat. I mean, that's most of Western Europe. There's no net population growth from reproduction. So that's a really important idea to get on board and to take to heart, because it means it's really about, first of all, it's about us. We can't blame this problem on the, you know, growth of population in the developing world. It's really about us and our patterns of consumption. And so then the question becomes, how do we change that? And that's where it gets really tricky, because lots of people in the United States, if you try to talk about that, they accuse you of attacking the American way of life. And I always think of Dick Cheney's memorable remarks when he said, the American way of life is not up for negotiation. Well, maybe it needs to be up for negotiation, because the reality is that the American way of life isn't actually making most of us happy. You know, the rates of depression and anxiety in this country are sky high. So maybe it's possible to think about living a life that's less consumptive and still be really happy. And, you know, I was on a radio program last week with Dorothy Borse, a wonderful woman who was raised as a Mennonite. And, you know, she likes to point out, well, when we talk about the American way of life, a lot of us think it means the way we live today, but it's not a way of life that our grandparents would have recognized. And so much of the consumption and energy use has happened actually just in the last 50 years. So not even within the lifetime of our parents or our grandparents. It's a very, very recent thing. It's something that some scientists now are calling the Great Acceleration. So we can imagine stepping back from this and saying, wait, why did we have this whole explosion in the use of energy and materials in the last 50 years? Lots of people lived quite well and were pretty happy, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And if we think about energy efficiency and using technology not to make our cars faster, but to make our cars more efficient, you know, we could have a lot of good things we associate with modernity, but in a much less way. And we might actually be happier. And I think that's a conversation that we should all welcome, because, you know, again, it doesn't mean we're saying we have to suffer, but it's saying that if we don't fix this problem, we will suffer.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise, and I thank you again. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of the history of science and director of graduate studies at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. She is the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And their latest book is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the sixth mass extinction that is now underway.
Don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He has published widely on biodiversity and the fossil fuel record, and is an expert on mass extinctions. And his award-winning books include Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. He's the author of The Flooded Earth, How Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, and his latest book is A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Ward.
It's so good of you to have me, and thank you.
So, Peter, there's a report that was released on Friday in the journal Science Advances by scientists from Stanford, Princeton, and Berkeley, saying that we're in the sixth mass extinction phase, that the Earth is now entering it, and of course the fifth mass extinction was 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. Since you're an expert on mass extinctions, where do you put us? I mean, obviously we're talking on a long time scale here.
Well, we are, but unfortunately the time scale isn't long enough, Ian. We really are seeing that there are at least 10 extinctions as big as the ones posited. The trouble with the mass extinction work that's being done now, it's like presumed that animals prior to those with a backbone don't really count for mass extinction. If we go back to the time before we have animals at all, we had major catastrophes. I understand and I see that we are losing vertebrates, and the bulk of the study you're looking at is looking just at that. It's how fast are vertebrates, our kind, going extinct. But again, I think this is a very short-sighted look. If you really want to see when and how the current pulse of extinction is taking place, you should look when it started. Let's go and look at the biggest of all the creatures that should be counted in this mass extinction, the mammoths, the mastodons, and even those giant kangaroo-like forms in Australia. And that began 50,000 years ago. So most of the mammal extinction of this last even 20,000 years took place early on and had very little to do with humans. So we are looking at this pulse of extinction, all right. But on the other hand, if you really compare the metrics, the sort of sense of horrible scare that we are looking at something as big as anything in the past just is not correct. The Permian extinction, the end Cretaceous extinction, they're far more devastating and faster than what is being posited for today.
So how do you distinguish between environmental mass extinction and, for example, the extinction of the African elephants, which we know why they're taking place. They're taking place largely because of poaching for ivory. And in the terms of the tiger, it's the Tibetan poachers that are killing it off. So it's definitely man at his worst in terms of... Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. And I think a guy named Richard Baumbach, another paleontologist, had, I think, the best sort of new look at this. He said, don't call them mass extinctions. Let's call them mass depletions. And clearly, we are seeing a depletion in so many different kinds of animals. Extinction is very difficult to do. I mean, you have to get every one of those breeding pairs. And in fact, we're going to not have the extinction of tigers or elephants. We'll keep them in zoos or somehow around. But nevertheless, what really is taking place is mass depletion on a scale that is truly horrific. We are seeing now that many stocks of animals and plants and invertebrates are being reduced in number, and human overpopulation and habitat change is clearly involved. It just gets very tricky, though, and it's so easy to fall into hyperbole when you start comparing what we're doing now to the past mass extinctions, all of which had very different causes than what ostensibly we humans are doing to the planet.
So, in other words, this new report should be even more damning, but the finger should be pointing at us, not some external environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, I think that we've got to be very careful. The environmental arena lets itself open to people like Lombard and this skeptical environmentalists. And just as we've seen where imprecise work in climate change opens the door for people who totally misrepresent and change, we just have to be so clearly conservative and not yelling, oh my gosh, you know, once again, we've got one of these major mass extinctions. We have something that's just different from anything that's happened in the past. You cannot compare it. You are seeing processes that we humans are doing that are unlike an asteroid coming down, and they're certainly unlike most of the mass extinctions, which are caused by really rapid temperature rise, really low oxygen and killing hydrogen sulfide coming out of the oceans. That's not happening.
Well, just to be fair to the study, though, perhaps I may have mischaracterized it a little bit here. The authors of this, the researchers wrote that our analysis emphasizes that our global society has started to destroy species of other organisms at an accelerating rate, initiating a mass extinction episode unparalleled for 65 million years. Avoiding a true sixth mass extinction will require rapid, greatly intensified efforts to conserve already threatened species and to alleviate pressures on their populations, notably habitat loss, overexploitation for economic gain, and climate change. However, the window of opportunity is rapidly closing.
Well, there's certainly a lot to be alarmed with, but again, without being a stick in the mud here, if you go back to the Permian extinction, when 90% of all species disappeared, or the end Cretaceous that they talk about, which has now been thought to be at least 75% of species, we are not coming anywhere close to that. The species that have gone extinct are bird species on islands, they're mammal species on islands. It is these tiny habitats which become overrun with humans where most of those extinctions have taken place. This is not to say that we can't get up to the Permian extinction levels over the next centuries or millennia if we keep at it. But to say that we're there now, I think, is a misrepresentation.
Well, I think it doesn't say that we're there now, that we're entering our sixth mass extinction phase. So I guess that's not quite the same.
Well, yeah, maybe they're correct in the entering, but again, I just haven't even looked at these other mass extinctions when you see that things all the way down to the size of bacteria are going out. We are definitely taking out mammals, and we're taking out birds especially that are so narrowly adapted. But the great mass extinctions not only took out the narrowly adapted, they took out the generalists too. It was almost like the great David Raup pointed out, mass extinction, is it bad genes or bad luck, really, because almost everything across the board goes out. I think it's an absolute service now to point out that we are seeing so many species going extinct that we can blame directly on habitat change and habitat loss. But a mass extinction takes out everything, really. You go all the way down to the protozoa in a pond. And again, we really do not even know how many species there are on the planet, whereas we have a much better handle of how many there were in the deep past. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna about this, but it's just figures have to be done so carefully. There has to be such a conservative view. But nevertheless, looking at what we're seeing today, it's scary.
Well, we were just speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who teaches the history of science at Harvard University and has written about global warming deniers and has written a book on the collapse of Western civilization, a view from the future, which sort of posits what the world would look like if the efforts to deal with climate change are not sabotaged as they have been for some time by the deniers. And if the deniers win the argument, if the you know, the chairman of the Senate and House science committees have their way, they portray a world with 11 meters rise in sea level, surely that would create what may not be mass extinctions, but my God, there's going to be a lot of extinction, wouldn't there be, with that kind of sea level rise?
Yeah, and I think the sea level rise isn't going to kill the species. What's going to happen? The sea level rise is going to push human civilization into new areas, and we will have to increase our farmlands. In my book, The Flooded Earth, sea level rise was the most dangerous aspect of climate change to me, simply because so much of human agriculture takes place at very low elevation. The rice fields of Asia, you don't need 11 meters of sea level change to totally perturb that. Bangladesh, for heaven's sake, 11 meters is going to cover the vast majority of that country. 1 meter of sea level rise is going to put huge pressure on Bangladesh to be able to feed itself, which it currently can. And so there it becomes the indirect effect of now some forests that are still left and are not taken down will have to be, because we will need to increase the farmland. So here's where the nasty sort of aspect of it comes around.
So is there, do you think, in terms of the Pope's encyclical that we were talking about earlier, is there, are you feeling a little encouraged? You wrote the book, The Flooded Earth, clearly, and I remember we talked about some of the solutions that you thought were attainable that could make a difference, like if everybody on the planet painted their roofs white and the roads were white and parking lots were white, a lot of sun would get reflected. That doesn't seem like a terrible hardship on us humans. The Pope has, I think, come out pretty strongly, hasn't he?
Oh, the Pope's been amazing. Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, if we look at what has happened in the public consciousness in the last 10 years, and I kind of like to put it at the whole conversation about marriage between same-sex people, even 10 years ago, that was so verboten in the United States, and that so quickly changed. It's akin to, I think everyone now understands that climate change is real and that it is a force that is taking place. And I think even 10 years ago, maybe only 10% of the populace would have been worried or haven't even heard about it. So yeah, it's like a 12-step program. We have acknowledged that there is a problem, at least most of us, but the set of solutions keeps running up against the rapid population growth. And I heard your last speaker so eloquent that this heading up to 9 billion people is going to put more and more and more pressure on the habitats to the left.
And if the sea level rises only a few meters, that will even make greater pressure on the remaining habitats, which will be tried to turn them into some kind of agricultural land.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. Some of the new figures that come out, for instance, I just heard that Nigeria is expected to have a population of 400 to 500 million people by the end of the century, a half billion people in Nigeria alone. And the surface area of Nigeria is about the size, I think it's less than Washington State and Oregon, a piece of Oregon. You're not talking about a very large piece of real estate.
Right.
And then you're going to have a half billion people. So there's a place where you had forests and you had a great number of species. I think where we can finally get to, yes, indeed, there is this major mass extinction. If we lose two things on the planet irrevocably, the coral reefs and the rainforests are the two great arcs of diversity. If they are indeed destroyed, if we lose the coral reefs, then we've got problems.
Well, we have to end it there, but I thank you very much for joining us, Sir Peter Ward.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He's published widely on biodiversity and fossil fuel records and is an expert on mass extinction. And among his award-winning books is Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. He's the author of The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And his latest book is A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.